Welcome to Comic Talk Today for Thursday, January 10th, 2019. Man, I almost said 2018 again. I can't get used to this. Welcome. Today's episode is a Throwback Thursday episode. Of course, I started Throwback Thursday last week because I want to read some old stuff. I love new stuff, but I love old stuff too. So I was looking, I was like, what do I want to read? And I had recently read Grant Morrison's Invisibles. And I was like, I'm going to do that. And matter of fact, I put it on the schedule for the podcast. You can check the show notes for the schedule on what the episodes will be about. But I started rereading and I was like, you know what? I'm going to hold this off because I need to savor this a little bit more. And as a matter of fact, there's a couple people that want to join in on the Invisible discussion. So I'm going to move that to maybe the next one in a couple of weeks. Today's episode of Throwback Thursday is very near and dear to my heart. Because today we're going to be talking about Batman Holy Terror. One of the best Elseworlds stories of all time. In my opinion, at least. It is one of the first. Matter of fact, technically, I guess Batman Holy Terror is the first Elseworlds story. It was the first Elseworlds to actually get the Elseworlds logo on the cover. And for those of you that are a little bit younger, you may not remember what Elseworlds are about. Because shame on DC, they quit doing them. I mean, they still do Elseworlds stories. But back in the day, we used to get these all the time. There were either like miniseries or graphic novels usually. And there's a lot of really good ones. And they would put this Elseworlds thing on it. And they would just be retelling of particular comic book stories in kind of an alternate reality, I guess you could say. That's why they're called Elseworlds. And I figured, you know what? With the CW Elseworlds thing just recently wrapping up, perfect time to do this. So today we're talking about Batman Holy Terror from 1991. It is written by Alan Brennert with art by the incredible Norm Breyfogle. In fact, I would say this is my favorite art of any comic book by Norm Breyfogle. Colors by Laverne Kandirsky and letters by Bill Oakley. And this one's cool. It's very different. It is very dark. I will warn you ahead of time. It is very dark. And it's an interesting plot behind this whole thing. In some ways, I would say this is kind of like if Batman met The Handmaid's Tale, you would get Batman Holy Terror. So I know Handmaid's Tale is very popular. I love that show. It's a great show. Very creepy, very dark, very saddening in many respects. But this kind of takes place in a similar world. And to kind of give you some basic background on the story, this takes place in the U.S., except it's not called the United States. I don't think they ever actually mention it. They only call it the Commonwealth because this has a little bit of an alternate history tint to it. So those of you that are in the U.K. may know all about Oliver Cromwell. Those of you in the U.S. may not. I'm not going to go into Oliver Cromwell, look it up. But basically, he ruled England for a little while after deposing the monarchy and had some interesting ideas. Didn't work out very well. I believe his head was put in a spike on top of the Parliament building, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that. But he died in 1658 from syphilis, if I'm not mistaken. And this world kind of kicks off from that. And in this world, Oliver Cromwell did not die in 1658. In fact, he ruled England for another 10 or so years. And as a result, things changed quite a bit. The whole world changed quite a bit. And we do get to learn quite a bit about this world from Vicki Vale. We're going to get to that in a second. And it's very dark. And it's very much ruled by a government that has never separated church and state. So all the ruling folks of this commonwealth, or there's not like a president or whatever, or a cabinet. It's just ruled by clergy. And it's pretty interesting in the imagery. And it's very important actually towards the end of the story, in a point that I want to get to that's actually really, really interesting about this. If you are one of those people that don't like religious imagery, you might not dig this book. If you feel like somehow this, quote unquote craps on your religious ideology, this may not be for you. But I don't think it does either of those things. I think it's actually extremely well told story with some very interesting changes to the Batman mythology that work really, really well in the story. And as the book kicks off, we learn a little bit about this whole Commonwealth place and how they're pretty much constantly at war with different factions. But we kick things off with the death of Thomas and Martha Wayne. And it's a very quick thing, but it is a key aspect of this entire story. Now, Thomas and Martha Wayne do work for the state. They work for the Commonwealth. And they are killed by someone on the side of the road. And it is up to Inquisitor Gordon. Remember, these are all religious terms, so he's not a detective or anything yet. He is an inquisitor, and he is trying to figure out who killed the Waynes. and ends up finding out that it's Joe Chill. Of course, we kind of all know that story if you've been reading Batman for a while. And he goes and takes it to court because he wants to get some permission to go and further investigate. And the judge is like, no, you don't need to investigate. This guy didn't do it. He's been in the Coventry, which is kind of like a prison slash reform place, I guess, for criminals. He's like, you know, he's been in a Coventry for a while. There's no way he killed these people. And Gordon's like, well, look, I know he killed them. I want to investigate it. It's kind of hard to do it now because Joe Chill's been killed. Matter of fact, he was killed a few days after the death of the Waynes. He's like, I want to know what's going on. And the judge is like, nope, there's no grounds here for investigation. This is done. So, of course, that sets up kind of the story where we are kind of beginning to see that there may be something else going on here, right? If the judge is so adamant about this guy not being the killer, maybe he's partially responsible. And we do learn that maybe he is. Now, after this whole scene is when we get to meet Vicki Vale. She is, of course, a reporter, except here she's named Victoria Vale because we don't want heathens with nicknames on the news in a very, very religious state. So she goes by her full name, Victoria Vale. And she tells us quite a few things about this world, which easily helps us catch up. I like the way this was done, because oftentimes you have to kind of see these things through flashbacks or narration, and, you know, there's only so much you can tell in a 48-page story. I think this book is about 48 pages, maybe a little bit more. But because she's telling us the news, we're watching a news report on TV, we get to learn a lot about this place, and it's a crazy place that this Batman is living in. There's uprisings all over the world. It seems like the Commonwealth has spread itself through Manifest Destiny, for those of you that may remember your history lessons, has spread itself throughout the entire Western Hemisphere, and the only place that really is not under the control of the Commonwealth is French Guinea, if I'm not mistaken, is what they say in here. Except it seems like maybe those people are kind of giving up, and finally the Commonwealth is going to take over the entire hemisphere. It is kind of, in a way, similar to what kind of maybe Nazi Germany tried to do, although they talked a bit here about how Nazis... These people aren't Nazis, and I like that whole thing as well. I think the way that it was presented was well done. Because, yes, they are authoritarian, but it is a very different kind of authority that they're giving. Because here, they're being led by the authority of God, whereas in Nazi Germany, it would not be so. It would be the authority of the Führer. So that was kind of cool to see that in there. But it's a terrible place regardless. The Commonwealth is constantly at war. They have taken over many countries in the world. We don't know a whole lot about maybe other places. There is some mention of Europe, how maybe Europe doesn't necessarily agree with this whole thing, but maybe they do. We do learn about Oliver Queen, and there's quite a few characters of DC lore that do pop up in this book, which I think is different from other Elseworlds stories where we don't see as many of them, where they do become, especially if it's a Batman book, where it's kind of centrally Batman. This one has a lot of, like, Justice Society stuff, and I'm going to get to those in a second. And I love that, because I love that era of DC Comics where the JSA was around with, you know, Alan Scott as a Green Lantern and all that stuff. I love that kind of thing. That's why Starman is one of my favorite books, because Starman plays around a lot with the idea of Golden Age heroes and the passing of time and how that changes. So some of that stuff is being brought in here. So if you dig that kind of thing, if you're a huge DC fan and understand these characters and know these characters and love these characters, then this is just a plethora of Easter eggs. And of course, because this was written in 91, there is maybe we're a little bit closer to the time frame in which those characters were around, so I like that as well. But we do learn a little bit about Oliver Queen. He was tried and convicted for sedition. Apparently, he was protecting a Jewish pornographer, Isaac Singer. I didn't get to research a whole lot of that. I think Isaac Singer was actually a real person from the 19th century. This book does not take place in the 19th century. Although it does, in many respects, feel like it does take place in the late 1800s, maybe pre-World War I, like early 1900s. I don't think that's the case, because later we're giving kind of a figure of cycles. They call them cycles instead of years, and they're talking about 342 cycles of this one thing happening. And so what I've always deducted from this is that it takes place in the probably late 90s, maybe early 2000s. So even then, still future from the time of this story. But really well done, really well done. I love the amount of tidbits that we're giving in that news report with Vicki Vale. We learn about how rights work for people here, where people are allowed to vote, but they can vote based on their status in this world. So white landowners get basically two votes, whereas white non-landowners get one vote. And they're talking about women getting the right to vote in here because they weren't able to before. They were kind of seen the same as minorities. And as a result of the events in this book, we're learning that suffrage is kind of a thing and women are getting the right to have one vote, like non-land-owning white men can. Whereas minorities is not quite the case. Minorities have a half vote, unless they're extremely wealthy, in which case they get 75% of a vote. I thought that was kind of interesting, too. If you're familiar with U.S. history and the whole thing about when slaves began to receive the right to vote, how it was kind of a fraction of a vote, I thought that was a pretty fascinating way to put that in here as well. Because not necessarily, I mean, there is some obvious racism implied in the way this is done, but, you know, there's the economic structure, I guess, of the society is much more complex than what we have come to know and love. And I love that. I love when an Elseworlds story really grabs the Elseworlds titles by the balls. Okay. I'll just say it like that. Cause you can change one or two things in a story and make them in Elseworlds, right? But this one like goes all in. You have so much background and history just implied within the first few short pages. And I think it sets up the rest of the book quite nicely. We then cut to Bruce Wayne, who has decided to kind of sell off Wayne Manor. He is letting Alfred go, so we get an interaction between those two characters. And Alfred's like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, I'm sure. Like, I'm letting all this go. I'm going to join the clergy. And that's the reason why I wants to sell it. Bruce is extremely religious, and so he's going to join the clergy and be part of the state. And so he's selling all his possessions. And this takes place kind of, I think, 22 years after the death of his parents. So the timeline is a little bit different from what we may remember as Batman fans, but it works pretty well here as well. And so, you know, they kind of embrace each other and Alfred leaves. And as Alfred's leaving, you know, Inquisitor Gordon shows up and he's like, Bruce, I got to talk to you. And he's like, okay, what's going on? They are friends, of course. He's like, what's going on? He's like, well, remember how I investigated your parents' death? And Bruce is like, yeah. He's like, well, I may not have told you the whole story. He's like, I told you that we didn't never found the killer, but that's not true. I actually did find the killer. His name's Joe Chill, but we can never bring him to justice because he was killed, coincidentally, a few days after. And I'm pretty sure that this was kind of a government thing. The government killed your parents. And this kind of throws Bruce's whole world kind of in a downturn, right? In a spin. Because this guy is giving up his family fortune, all the prestige that's associated with his money and his stance in life, to become basically a priest. He's going to be running one of the local chapels. And Bruce is like, how can you do this to me? My entire life, I've wanted to follow in the service of God, and now you're telling me that my God killed my parents. And that's important because it does come up again in kind of the next sequence of events. But, you know, Gordon's like, look, I didn't mean to do it. I just want you to know the truth. He's like, you don't want to tell me the truth. You want to make your conscience feel better. And that's true. But at the same time, as we learn in the next few pages, that is also kind of what Bruce's parents were doing. And when Bruce realizes this, he decides to take a different set of actions to determine his future. So after he gets to, you know, talk to Gordon a little bit, he's very upset. He goes and decides to talk to Dr. McKinder, who is, I guess, his parents, one of his best friends. He knew his parents for a very long time, even since before Bruce was born. And, you know, he tells the doctor, like, this is what Gordon told me. How could this be true? And so that's when the doctor reveals that, listen, your parents and I were in the underground. We fought against this oppressive regime. We didn't want this stuff to happen. So we tried to work however we could within the institution to make things right. So his parents actually ran clinics, underground clinics, for people that were kind of trying to be different than what the government wanted to do. And he gives some examples. Bruce actually gets a journal from the doctor, and Bruce is reading from the journal, from Thomas's journal, Thomas Wayne's journal. And Thomas talks about these people that are going to like internment clinics to try to make them not be gay. It talks about prostitutes like, mutilating their genitalia because they don't want to be prostitutes because it's against God's will. And things like that. And Bruce is just very depressed. I warned you guys, this was going to get a little dark. But it's fantastic. And Bruce is like, oh my God, how can the government do this to people? I always thought that people were happy with their lot in life, with what the state gave us, with what God gave us. But that's not necessarily the case because these people are using God's word to kind of forge their own future. And I love that kind of thing. I really do. I've always been fascinated with religion and cults and the way that people work and the way that they twist beliefs in order to kind of come up with an ideology to shape those around them. And of course, we see this quite a bit nowadays. There's a lot of authoritarian regimes around the world kind of coming back into play. And that's something that we hadn't seen, you know, since like the 50s and 60s. Now, we all thought communism was dead after the Cold War, I guess you could say that. That's not at all true. I mean, obviously, China is a communist country. Russia is a communist country. But there's many others around the world. And I urge you to kind of go outside your bubble and see what's happening around the world, because it's very interesting. Again, I don't like to bring politics in here. And obviously, I don't want to talk about the current state of politics in the U.S. But there is a lot more than what we see here in the U.S. So go in and become a better person and learn about other people around the world. Anyways, after this meeting with McNider, he's like, all right, I need to figure out what's going on. And McNider says a really cool line that kind of goes with what I just said. Oliver Cromwell's church was tolerant, kind, the antithesis of this. And yet they twist his words and the words of the Bible to justify their oppression, as tyrants have done throughout history. That doesn't mean the words aren't true or that your God isn't just. And I love that line, right? Because Bruce is having this existential crisis. God killed my parents. And the doctor's like, look, God didn't kill your parents. The word of God is true. It's just the way that people are interpreting these words is not. And that's really deep, right? Something that I don't think we see in comics very often. And definitely not something that we see in comics very often nowadays. Maybe in like small indie books, but for DC to put out a book that says these kind of things, I think it says a lot. And of course, this era was very different, I think, right? If you grew up reading comics in the 80s, you might have seen a lot more of this, where writers were expressing certain viewpoints in their comics. I don't think we see that anymore. Not as much, at least. Especially with people getting, threatened to be killed on Twitter and whatever. It's just craziness. But I love that line, right? And it's really a key theme of this book. I also like how the doctor kind of tells Bruce about all these other people that were helping his parents. And I'll give you some names. Alan Scott ran an underground radio network. Of course, Alan Scott being the original Green Lantern. Carter and Shearer were smuggling weapons using their archaeology permits. Of course, Hawkman and Hawkgirl. That's freaking awesome. Rex Tyler manufactured drugs to be distributed in these underground clinics. And not like hallucinogenic, illegal, whatever drugs. Like medicine to be used by these doctors in their clinics. Of course, Rex Tyler being our man. And Bruce is like, you know what? I need to figure out what I'm going to do. But I need to continue with my path. I can't let the state know that I know these things now. And what better way to get inside than to be part of the inside, right? So Bruce continues to do his clergy thing. He goes to his clergy appointment and, you get to see some inner monologue of him as he's talking about the fact that, you know, I don't even know what these people are saying to me right now. All I'm focusing is how I'm going to get my revenge for my parents' death. And he does. After he gets, inducted by the clergy, he goes back home and he goes down to a cave that he remembers being in when he was a kid. Of course, the bad cave. And in the cave, there's a chest, and in the chest, there's some old clothes. And as part of these old clothes, he finds one of Thomas Wayne's old Halloween costumes. Because for a Halloween party, a very ritzy Halloween party one year, Thomas Wayne dressed up as a demon. And so this is the costume that Bruce decides to wear to become Batman. And I love that as well, right? Because I have seen this kind of thing done before outside of Batman Holy Terror, where there is a definite connection between Bruce and Thomas in terms of a lineage of Batmen, I guess you could say. And this is beyond, the Flashpoint Batman that we have now that we've seen in, for example, Tom King's Batman. This is going a long times off. I remember, what was it? Grant Morrison did that, I think, in his run. When they were going through the return of Bruce Wayne after he gets quote unquote killed by that magical bullet, and really interesting stuff, a lot of cool references to stuff that's happened before and stuff that we've seen kind of transformed in a way over the years, surely based partially at least on some of the stuff that's being brought up here in Batman Holy Terror. Well, now Batman's got his suit. He decides to go after the judge that Commissioner Gordon told him about. Or Inquisitor Gordon, excuse me, told him about. So he goes to the judge's house and he does this cool, like, I'm a demon, like, God's avenging angel kind of thing, right? He shows up and the judge is sleeping and he jumps through the window. The judge wakes up and he's like, ha, you knew all along that you would be judged at one point for your actions. You've killed this people and torn arms from people and, whatever, beheaded folks. And the judge has no qualms about what he did, right? And Bruce is like, listen, you killed Alan Scott and Carter and Shearer and Rex and all these people. And they're just like, yeah, they were traitors to the state. Of course I killed them. I did the right thing. And that's also really interesting, right, too? Because when you truly believe so hard within every aspect of your being that you're doing the right thing, if somebody else feels like that's not the right thing, what's the moral quandary there, right? We see this a lot nowadays with the truthiness, the fake news stuff. I find that fascinating as well. And Bruce tries to get kind of try to get the guy to admit what he did, and the guy admits it freely. And he's like, but I didn't kill him. That came on from above. It came from the Star Chamber. And the Star Chamber being kind of one of these other historical judicial branches of government that has kind of come and gone a couple of times in history. And now it's kind of a big thing here. And they're basically like the underground ruling elite of the state, right? It's kind of like, maybe kind of like the CIA in some ways, but a little more conspiracy theory kind of CIA. So Bruce decides to go to the Star Chamber, and he goes in there, and he's looking around. He manages to get past some of the guards because, he's dressed as a clergy. They know him. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to do some research. They're like, okay, cool, have a good night. And he goes in and starts looking around. He changes into his Batman demon costume and finds this underground lab. And in the lab, we meet a ton of other folks that you might recognize. I'm not going to spoil most of them, but the first one he meets that's important is Barry Allen. He is not the Flash, but he is behind this glass cage. And he's like, what are you doing there? And Barry's like, listen, I was a scientist for the state. I got into this lab explosion, and now I have these abilities to change my molecules. They don't talk about the super speed. They talk about the transmutation molecules, where he can phase through things. But I can't phase out of this prison because he's created this glass that resonates at whatever frequency I'm resonating. And of course, Bruce starts thinking, and being the great detective that he is, he's like, well, why don't you resonate at two different frequencies? And I've seen this before too, right? We've seen this in comics before. Matter of fact, I think they did this on the CW show last season. And he's like, huh, two frequencies. So he puts one hand through and he's vibrating, and then he moves the other one at a different frequency and the whole cage explodes. So now Barry Allen comes out, and Barry explains to him all these experiments, and he's showing him all the people that are around. And I won't spoil most of them, but Aquaman is in one of these cages, except through all the experimentation, he's kind of comatose. He's a vegetable. So he's just kind of floating around in a tank in a fetal position. And he's been used for breeding because the government wanted to get, these breathing underwater abilities. And so they bred him with this other woman and created this mermaid monster thing. And it was really cool to see. It was so well done. And so depressing, right, when you see the way that the government was treating these people. As all this is happening, this witch pops out of nowhere, and I didn't recognize the character, and I've never looked at her up. It may be somebody, but this witch comes out and starts fighting Barry and Bruce. And she's like, you guys are traitors of the state, this side and the other, and she wears, of course, a cape with a giant cross on the back of it. And they're fighting it out, and she does all these spells, right, and they're really just words typed backwards on the page. And we get a little bit of history about that as well, where after the Salem witch trials, instead of killing off all the witches in Salem and around the world, the government decided that they could use these abilities in order to further their own goals, I guess you could say. So they enlist witches, they brainwash witches and use them as soldiers in their army to conquer other lands. And that's pretty cool too, right? Of course, they're not probably like really witches, right? They're just, what do they call them at DC? Metas? They're probably just metas with certain abilities that go beyond kind of what Barry or, Aquaman or somebody like that would have. Because she shoots projectiles from her hands, for example. Well, anyways, they end up defeating the witch, and then the guy in charge of this place, Dr. Erdl, comes out, and, Barry's like, I'm gonna kill you, you mother effer. Doesn't say a bad word. And he starts running super fast towards him, and the doctor has kind of been researching Barry for a long time, so he knows how to neutralize the abilities, and he pretty much sets him on fire. He overstimulates the friction around Barry's body and sets Barry on fire, so Barry's dead. And him and Bruce start duking it out, and they end up going into this chamber, and out of this chamber comes out Clayface, who is also one of these characters that's been being researched and brainwashed to serve the state. So Bruce and Clayface duke it out. The whole time Erdl is kind of explaining how this lab works and why they're doing this kind of thing, more exposition for the story. They overtake Bruce, and they bring him into this one room because he's like, the ultimate goal is Project Green Man. And at first I thought it was going to be like Martian Manhunter, but it's not. Project Green Man ends up being Superman because, of course, green from the kryptonite. And when I saw that, I was like, man, that is so cool, like the way that this was brought out. And they talk about how, you know, there was this couple that was very loyal to the state. They found this baby in Kansas, and they brought him in because he had abilities, and they've tried to break him, but they can't break him. So Superman's either dead or also comatose. And he's kind of hanging in a way where he's crucified. So there is quite a bit of Jesus crucifixion imagery as well in here. And that reminds me of one of the lines. Let me pull it up, because the line that Bruce says is awesome. When he's brought into the room and he sees the green man finally after Ertl's been talking about him, he says, "I have no idea who the man is. I've never seen him before in my life. But suddenly I feel an unfathomable sense of loss, of sorrow, of hope destroyed and discarded. And I know somehow that Ertl is right, that the state can destroy virtually any threat to it, that it has already destroyed, that it may have been, and that I have no idea how I know this, but I do. This world's greatest hope." I thought that was so cool. So cool. Because it shows us that even though these are Elseworld stories, these characters in some way, shape, or form maybe know that they're not in their own reality. And that was fascinating, because just seeing Superman up here, Bruce automatically knows, like, this is Superman. He's the world's greatest hope. Without him, we're lost. That's why the world is in this place, because we don't have a Superman. And I thought that was so awesome, right? Because I love Batman. Batman is my favorite. But Batman, or Superman, has always been that sense of hope, right? For the longest time, right? Kind of the American dream, the perfect person. And what would happen if we didn't have a Superman? Would this be what we get? Could it be other repercussions? I mean, they've dealt with some of this stuff in other Elseworld stories as well. But I just love the way that this was done. And it kind of makes me think, like, well, is this why some of these other people are part of the underground? Because they somehow, maybe not consciously, but they still know that this is not the way that things are meant to be. I thought that was just so fascinating, especially being part of an Elseworlds, right? And Superman never does recover from this. We never see him come up. But he is there. And this kind of gives Bruce the motivation to go up against Clayface and Ertl and basically kills both of them. Matter of fact, the way that Ertl dies is kind of funny, if you can call death funny. He starts, he takes Clayface down, Ertl starts shooting at Batman, and Batman jumps behind Superman, maybe because he knows, right, subconsciously from this other alternate reality, that Superman is bulletproof, and the bullets bounce off of Superman and kill Ertl. So, Batman goes off after seeing all this stuff, and he goes deep into the Star Chamber, meets this clergyman who, he's like, "Listen, I'm trying to do the research on this thing." And the guy's like, "Look, I can't help you. Nobody's responsible for these people's deaths, because when we vote for executions, it's all done as a blind ballot. So nobody knows who voted yes, who voted no, if there were any objections, what the objections were. Everything's done in secret." So that's when Bruce realizes, like, okay, well, my quest for vengeance isn't after one particular person. It's against this entire state. So that's kind of where we lead off, where Bruce decides to become kind of the spirit of vengeance in a way, and very different from ours, because he is led very much by his religious beliefs, right? And he says so towards the end of the book, where, you know, he's going to be kind of God's soldier in order to bring justice to those who cannot get justice from the state. And I thought that was really well done as well. I love this book. This is one of my all-time favorite Elseworld stories. If you've never read it, I highly recommend you do. You can probably pick these up in a dollar box. I've had this particular copy of mine for years and years and years, and I love it. I've read it many, many times, and like I said, this might be some of my favorite Breyfogle art, and the story is fantastic. Especially if you're a DC fan with all the nods to other characters, I think you will love it. If I'm going to rate it, it's going to be a 25 out of 10. I can't do 7 ratings anymore. Or half ratings, but I can do ridiculous more than 5 ratings. And I just love this book. Go pick this one up if you get a chance. And pick some of the other Elseworld stuff as well. I think they're really, really well done for the most part. That's going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thank you for listening. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at Geekvine. You can email yell@comictalk.today. You can find the show wherever you get your podcasts. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher. What am I missing? I'm missing some. It's also on the Echo, so you can ask your Echo to enable Comic Talk Today, and I'll be on your speaking device. We're about to be on Pandora, too. Pandora's launching a podcasting beta, so I just had to sign some paperwork, apparently. I don't know. I had to sign paperwork to be on Pandora. That'll be coming up soon, so stay tuned. Thank you for listening. Dustin will be back tomorrow with the headlines, and I'll catch you on the next one.